There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 855. This episode's brought to you by Audible. Hey, are you a reader? Well, that's good. Reading is good, but you know, you don't always have time to be a reader, so be a listener. Go to Audible. They have audiobooks from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine, newspaper publishers, business information providers. You can catch up on anything that you would normally read, but you could listen to it because sometimes that's just more expeditious. If you're on public transportation, or you're in your car, or you're at work, or whatever, and you've run out of Nerdist podcasts, I imagine you've gone back and listened to all 855 episodes from the beginning, then you would go to Audible. So, for instance, I just noticed that Neil Gaiman wrote a giant collection of Norse mythology. So, and he reads it on Audible. Now, if you've ever heard Neil Gaiman's voice, you know that you wish it was the voice that spoke to you in your head all the time, because it's a fantastic voice. And it happens to belong to a brilliant man. So check out Norse Mythology, at read by Neil Gaiman on Audible. And Audible's offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/Nerdist today to start your free trial. And now it's time for another visit to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. So, first of all, let me tell you that I will be performing March 3rd and 4th at the Irvine Improv. I'm doing stand-up. It's a whole new set. I'm working it out, because someday I'm going to do a new special. So, please come see me at the Irvine Improv with my best friend Mike Furman, who will be opening, and April Richardson, who will also be opening. And maybe we'll do some songs while you're there. So if you go to irvine.improv.com, you can find it and grab tickets to that. So hopefully you'll see you out there behind the orange curtain, as we say in Southern California. Anyone else who doesn't get that reference or live here, please disregard. Also, we have a bunch of other podcasts on the Nerdist Podcast Network. We have Bizarre States with Jessica Chobot and Andrew Bowser. We have the Jonah Carey Podcast with Jonah Carey. And Chewing It with Kevin Heffernan and Steve Lemmy of Broken Lizard. Also, Half Hour Happy Hour with Allison Hayslip and Alex Albrecht. So much more. Find all our shows on Nerdist.com and on iTunes. And don't forget about the Nerd Melt Showroom at Meltdown Comics. Good, fun comedy happenings every single night, from Doug Loves Movies to their new Wednesday night stand-up show, The Rabbit Hole, with Jay Larson and Rory Scovel. Find info and tickets at nerdmeltla.com. This episode is Jordan Peele, who is promoting Get Out, which is a fucking great movie. It's a horror thriller movie. I don't want to tell you. I mean, there are no spoilers in this podcast about it, by the way. We talk around it. So don't worry. If you have not seen the movie yet, you can listen to this podcast, but you should definitely see the movie. This is Jordan Peele's feature film directorial debut, and he does a fucking amazing job. Obviously, you know Jordan from Key and Peele, but he is a comedy. He is comedy lightning in a bottle. I don't know why in a bottle, but people just say that. So it just sounded weird to not say in a bottle after lightning. He could be free range lightning too. I'm getting a call about that right now. The president of lightning is calling me. He's not happy with what I just said about lightning in a bottle. I apologize. All right. I apologize. Lightning doesn't always have to be in a bottle. Sometimes lightning can just be out there. Get Out comes out Friday, February 24th, so you should absolutely go see it. He's nice. I like that Jordan Peele. He's a good egg, that Jordan Peele. This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com. Maybe I should write Jordan a letter. Not just an email or a text. Maybe I should write him a letter. Oh, crap, though. I don't have time to go to the post office. Hey, that's okay, because Stamps.com will save me time and money. which means it can also save you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. You can mail any letter, any package, using just your computer and your printer, and then the mail carrier just picks it up. That's it. Avoid the hassle. Don't go to the post office. Create your stamps account in minutes online with no equipment to lease, no long-term commitments. Click, print, mail, you're done. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print out your postage 24/7. It is convenient, it is reliable, it is easy and flexible. Stamps.com brings all the services of the post office right to your fingertips. So they're going to send you a digital scale. It's going to automatically calculate exact postage, and then you'll never waste any money on postage that you don't need. Right now, you can enjoy stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage in a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Here's the Nerdist podcast number 855 with the return of Jordan Peele. Katie, roll it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Movie Wolf, even though I tried to tell her how horribly flawed of a movie it is.
You know, it really, that movie comes, and you got some gremlins. Was that, did you get those from the Rick Baker auction?
She got, I think she got one from the Rick Baker auction. Yeah, from the prop store, the Rick
Baker. The
prop
store thing, yeah.
And then, I don't know where she got the other one. And then she got a Galaxy Quest gun.
Wolf to me is, it all comes down to the scene, the James Spader scene.
Yes.
Where he, the creepiest scene of all time, I just, like, it's just the best, like, 3 minutes of that scene.
Spader was the quintessential, like, handsome douchebag, but, like, there was all, in the 80s, he always played that guy,
yeah,
and in the
Blaine,
90s.
Right? Or what, Blake, from Pity and Pink, 16 Candles, whichever one he was originally.
He was in some kind of, No, that was Craig Sheffer. Yeah, I think it was Pretty in Pink.
Pretty in Pink played, yeah, the cokehead douchebag, yeah.
And in Less Than Zero. Was he not in Less Than Zero? Was he in Less Than Zero? No, that was Andrew McCarthy and Robert Downey Jr. Well, maybe he was in Less Than Zero, but he always played that guy that probably was giving coke to people.
Yes.
Like, always.
That's right.
So when he popped up again in Blacklist, I'm like, who is that? That's James Spader.
James Spader.
Yeah.
James Spader once cornered me and confessed to being like the biggest Key and Peele fan.
Holy shit.
And I felt like Michelle Pfeiffer in that scene in Wolf. Like, he was like, I was in a corner. We were at a party.
Did he try to give you cocaine too?
No, I wish. I would. James Spader is somebody I would go back to cocaine for and try a move with him. That would just be a story.
One more time for Spader.
One more time.
Come on. All right, Spader.
What else you got?
Oh, I have an unhealthy animation cell collection. And these are the framed ones, but I've had a bunch more upstairs.
Oh, wow. You got Orange Rabbit.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Jordan's in my home now. It's not an At Midnight shoot day, so sometimes I do these at my house.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
This is like a museum of my all my favorite stuff. This is like I'm very jealous, but I need to come back. You got Ned Ryerson.
Got a little Ned Ryerson up there.
Up there, a little picture of Ned Ryerson.
I haven't, and that's Igor over there over the other one, a little Marty Feldman.
You got Marty Feldman up in here.
Yep.
Just a,
it's a play palace.
Absolutely enviable collection.
Our generation really gets to live this. I can't imagine my parents like having toys.
Yeah, no.
In their like they wouldn't have ever thought that was okay.
No, well, there's something about this era that you and your wife are clearly fascinated with, and I'm fascinated with too. Like these late 80s, early 90s. Like the Howlings, the Roger Rabbits, the Rick Baker stuff. That is like it's kind of a special time in film. I think mainly because of the practical effects,
right?
You know,
and also the glut of with cable and the home video revolution that all sort of happened around the same time. Mm-hmm. We were so inundated with pop culture in a way. I mean, we had the ability to sort of control to an extent, not like today, but our parents, it's like something came on TV and if they missed it, they may never see it again.
That's right.
You know? And then now, I mean, then in the 80s, at least we could tape things and get a little control back.
Yeah, so. That's right.
So I think if we're just so pop culture obsessed because it was so much a part of the tapestry. And I assume you were a voracious, like in between going to computer school, I assume you were a voracious pop culture consumer.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm a total cinephile. By the time I got to high school, it was like I would go buy two VHSs a week. Like I'd get $20 to go, you know, in the beginning of the week to, you know, get miscellaneous food, snacks, and, you know, travel. I would go blow it on a movie. And so my friend and I, we just built this VHS collection that was like 300 or 400 movies strong.
What are you buying at the
It was time? You know, it was all movies in kind of in this world you're talking about. It was like Dead Again. It would have been Stand By Me. We would have been obsessed with things like The First Power. Just like real popcorn movies, genre films, and it was you know, anything good, anything cinematic.
We sort of talked about, because I don't want to spoil anything, but my wife and I watched Get Out last night, and it's fucking great.
Thank you.
And the reason, like, when we watch pretty much every horror, everything that comes out.
Yeah.
And so the thing as, like, really hardcore horror fans that we appreciated was that it's so wildly different from anything. I mean, usually, you know, there's such a glut of horror right now because it's an inexpensive genre that can pay off. Like if someone just, you know, $3 million movie can stumble across a $100 million horror franchise.
That's right.
And so the downside to that is, you know, you never really know what you're going to get when you see something. Right. And you go, all right, it's four teenagers with a fucking Ouija board. They're all going to die sequentially. And
that's right.
You know, but Get Out is such a, so I would love, so without giving anything away, because it is a, you know, it's a movie that you need to experience and you don't want spoiled.
Yeah.
But where did this come from?
Yeah. I mean, and you can, you know, I basically boiled down all my favorite movies. You know, I did, I tried to take a page out of the Tarantino book and say, like, don't shy away from my favorite moments, my favorite devices, the way the masters have inspired me. If I can figure out a way to, create a cohesive new story, there's something genuinely unique and special about it. So for me, it was Stepford Wives, Rosemary's Baby, really Ira Levin material. Mm-hmm. But then there's different scenes I'm pulling from different things. I definitely go, you know, like the way that the Overlook is a monster that hangs over The Shining. I tried to, like, you know, use the house in this movie in that way. You know, the first scene of the film takes place in, you know, this white suburban neighborhood. And I was talking about Halloween while we were shooting that scene the whole time and trying to capture that eeriness. So, there's probably about, you know, 20 movies I could take you through and, like, I pulled from.
'Cause it's not there are funny moments in it, but it's not a comedy.
Right.
I mean, there's a certain amount of social satire that I think we go, oh, that's really weird and funny that people, but there really is, it's so interesting to use horror to make, like, really poignant statements on race relations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because, you know, there are points in the movie where, you know, where people are trying to prove how racist they aren't.
Yes.
Which always sounds almost worse.
Sounds almost worse.
It's just like, if you're like, I know what you go through. I know what you guys are all, you know, and then you just kind of go cringe and go, oh no.
No, have I done that?
Oh, dude? I hope that's that. Oh, please.
Well, you know, and first of all, it's like, this isn't like a all white people are evil movie, although that's what it can look like.
Well, we are.
Not more than the rest of us. I do believe race is like this. It's something that we all have to deal with within ourselves, and we all have to look at ourselves first. But why I tote the Stepford Wives is like the biggest inspiration to me is like that's a movie about gender. That's a movie about, and Rosemary's Baby, but movies about men making decisions for women.
Mm-hmm. And roles. What, like who should be placed in what role?
Exactly. And you know, this was, those stories emerged, during the women's lib movement. And like when the pill became a thing, there was this realization that, you know, the way we look at gender is in this culture is subject matter for a horror movie. And so the fact that those are my favorite movies and I don't leave those movies feeling persecuted as a man, I feel in tune with what the leads are up to. That was a signal to me that we could do that with race.
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but what do you think is the most, What the underlying message, like, what do you want to come out of this? Like, extrapolating from the story, the specific story, and how the characters interact, what kind of feeling do you want people to leave the theater with? Or what do you want people to go, oh, that's really interesting, I never thought about blah?
Yeah, you know, there's many, as you know, there's a lot of layers going on. The movie kind of continues to unfold, I think, for people over the next couple of days after they sit and think about it. You know, my goal here was first and foremost to entertain people, just to get a movie that sort of addressed the horror movie audience and all of us that just wants to be like, get out the house, you know, pick up the phone and call the cops, you know, stop walking backwards towards a dark doorway.
Too bad we can't stay.
Yeah. Right. And of course, you know, I was alluding to that, you know, because in that bit, he references the Amityville, get out.
And the white people are always like, hang on a minute, let's see what we
can do. And then what, black people, get out. Too bad we can't stay, baby. I mean, you did the bit. But I wanted to fill a, you know, what I felt like was a missing piece of the cinematic puzzle and conversation in terms of giving black perspective some representation, but also giving that black need for characters to do smart stuff in movies to kind of sort of serve that audience, which is very loyal, but do it in an inclusive way that, you know, you don't, if you're not black, you can come to this movie and you can kind of be black for the movie. You can see the world through the eyes of this character. And it's very important for me for this movie to be inclusive and to honor the people who have come to this film by saying, look, this, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt that you are a perceptive, intelligent, emotive person, you know, because you're a horror fan like I am. And we can connect on entertainment. We can connect on fun. And if you come out of it and say, hey, you know what? I never thought about something this way. Or you can, you know, I would love if people took away from this movie on a deeper level the systematic, you know, incarceration of black men in the prison system. I mean, that's that, you know, on the deepest level, that is kind of what this movie is about, is that there is a perspective that, and there is a horror that has been neglected in this country and within the genre of horror films.
Is it racist to ask you about the race relations
no,
in the movie?
It's not.
Okay, great.
You're all good.
Okay, good. I think what makes a really good horror film, and so few horror films have them, is having it be about anything other than just, like, you know, sometimes it's just about, well, let's just murder the shit out of these people.
Right.
And that's fine if that's done really well. But to actually, and again, you know, I also want to make it very clear that it doesn't ever feel like, hey, he's hitting you over the head with his, like, it's just there.
Cool.
And it's a part of the story, which is great. And so, you know, I mean, I look at horror movies as like one-man shows. Mm. Where you sort of go like, well, most of them aren't great, Mm-hmm. But when you see a really good one, you go, oh, that's what it's supposed to be. Like, right. you sort of, part of the pursuit is that you mine through a lot of sameness, because when you discover one that's really different, you get really excited as a horror fan. And then you want to tell all of your friends about, oh, this is the one you got
to
see.
That was another thing that's attractive to me about this genre. I mean, besides the fact that it's my favorite, I'm into it. It feels like we get you know, a handful, sometimes less, of really great horror films a year. You know, so many years it feels like one, two, or zero.
Right.
That to me was like, okay, there's work to be done here. There's fun to be had, and if you can make something decent that resonates, it should be successful. To what you're saying about, you know, horror rarely saying something, I think that's true. But I also think that, you know, when a horror movie does take off and resonate, it usually does have some seed, and maybe in a subtle or sort of like, more allegorical way of a real horror. I think Stephen King is a great, example of like all of his books. It's like whether it's something like It that, you know, starts with this real horror of, you know, the notion of a serial killer who kills children in the town, and then, you know, it sort of it expands on that horror and says, well, what if it's not just a human? What if it's this demon? Or Pet Sematary, about the loss of a son.
Sometimes dead is better.
Ed Gwynn in there.
Yeah, sometimes dead is better.
Yeah, nice. I think in the future I may pull back on the sort of the direct social allegory and be a little bit more symbolic, a little bit more representative and more cinematic. But I'm obsessed with this idea of the social thriller.
That's such a great, it's such a great layer to add, because it also kind of helps you not have to go over the top with stunty stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I think people have to go over the top with stunty shit if they can't rely on the gravity of the story. They're like, oh, well, now we got to have someone like jump out, and, you know, there aren't really a lot of those "I'm gonna get you" moments. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly a couple of, you know, like when he's running across the back, like just those. And it's shot so well too, because it's definitely sort of plays on that, like, oh, that's unsettling on a very deep evolutionary level, that I'm not okay with whatever is happening right now.
Yes. I had to put a couple of these jump scares in. I thought about it. I was like, you know, this is a movie that could sort of stand as a subtler, whereas Kubrick with The Shining, there's like no jump scares and it's the most terrifying movie of all time. So elevated. But, you know, when I wanted to make a movie that makes people scream in the theater, I wanted to make a collaborative experience that's interactive. And like I said, like really kind of honor that audience. So I put them in there.
And the your lead actor,
Daniel Kaluuya.
Yes, Daniel, who at first, like, I was racking my brain, mm-hmm. and I realized, oh fuck, he was in Black Mirror.
Yeah.
And he's really great at playing a character who's sort of a vessel for the audience.
Yes.
You know, where he, because he's so seamless. And by the way, if you didn't know he was British, you would, his accent is flawless.
Flawless.
His American accent's flawless. But he's so good at being a vessel for the audience of like, oh, I can see myself as that guy.
Yeah, and that was huge for in the casting choice here. I mean, first of all, like, you see this film, this guy's, he's a star. I mean, as you've seen, he fills in the moments like just like one of the greatest actors in the world. He's my personal favorite actor right now. And he's got a relatability. He's got a warmth. You know, he feels like he could be, you know, your best friend or brother. But, you know, most importantly to me, he feels sharp. He feels like he is a protagonist who you can at least rest assured that, you know what, he's on to it. He's on to something. He's sensing something. He's no dumbass. He's not going to be walking backwards. into a dark room. Although there is a there's times where it gets close, but to that. But it, you know, the whole project for me was selling this idea of, yeah, we need the audience to relate, like, respect this character, and feel sort of taken care of by his intelligence.
Yeah. Well, everyone in the movie. Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener and the guy who plays his best friend, the TSA agent,
Little Rel Howery,
fucking hilarious.
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, I don't want to give away too much. Stephen Root's mm-hmm. great, and Allison Williams is flawless. So it really, I mean,
how about the Betty Gabriel who played Georgina?
Holy shit, that. Oh, fuck. Okay, I was about to give away a scene, but there is a scene where they're in the the bedroom.
Talk about that's in the trailer. It's
It is. Yeah, okay, and it's where she's just about to crack.
It's this performance, man.
It's incredible because it's not acty in any way. Like it just. Yeah. She's so solid.
Marcus Henderson, Lakeith Stanfield. Like, the cast in this movie was... I mean, can you imagine just... I mean, for a first-time director, getting this ensemble together and feeling so intimidated, like, holy shit, Catherine Keener is going to be in this film.
And they're looking up to you to know things about it, to tell them what to do.
Exactly. I mean, and... Even more with this one than usual, because I would think, because this is, if I get the tone wrong or somebody gets the tone wrong, like the thing could fall apart like a house of cards. We're in such dangerous territory, and we don't want the movie to be an exploitation of, you know, the real horrors and real, you know, victims of racial prejudice. We don't want it to be a total villainization of an entire race or mm-hmm. anything like that. You want it to play like on this level you're talking about, where the satire and the commentary is there, but ultimately you can just watch a good movie.
So I'm just talking about like what was personal about this for you, because at the core of it is a biracial relationship.
Yeah,
and you are biracial, and you are married. Chelsea is white.
So we're in an interracial thing. Yeah,
it's interracial, not biracial. Interracial, biracial. You are biracial. So the relationship
Yes, our household is about to become more biracial.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. Yes,
holy shit. You guys just got married like less than a year ago.
I know, we got busy fast.
I know, my wife, we got married in August, and she was like, oh, we'll wait like a year. I'm like, 2 years? You know, I was trying to like, you want to wait 2 years?
Yeah, well, you know, we knew what we were doing, and it still feels like it's caught me off guard.
Sure. I don't think anyone's ever, except for maybe the Duggar family, like, I don't think anyone's ever ready.
That's right.
who I assume at this point just give birth to pregnant babies. Like, I can't figure out. there's a human pyramid scheme is what's happening there. But at least with the... Yeah, so I mean, like, what an incredible... to feel like that. I mean, this is an incredible time for you.
It's a great time for me.
First baby, first movie.
And I mean, and you were talking about the identity being...
Yes.
You know, I've... You know, being mixed, being biracial, there is this... you know, there's a perspective that I think is relatively untapped in pop culture. And, you know, like, you know, Keegan and I said that there's, you know, when Obama was elected, it sort of opened, it intrigued people as to what the mixed identity is about. And it's sort of a nebulous thing for us and myself as well. You know, I definitely view myself as a black man. As an African American, you know, I have a white, you know, white family. You know, the side of my family that I grew up with is white, and there's, I think, part of being mixed in America feels like you get to be included in two different identities, but you also are kind of separate. And you're sort of in on the outside of being fully included. So I think for Keegan and I, with Key and Peele, it made us ask ourselves, well, what does our unique perspective here sort of provide? And, you know, ultimately it was like, you know, Key and Peele is what came out of that question. This movie is very much from the perspective of a black man. Specifically a black man who, you know, finds himself surrounded by white people and what that dynamic is, the presumptions that I might make, you know, as an African American in that situation, the presumptions that they will make, in that situation. And, it's great to be able to get the platform to, you know, put some of my perspective out there.
It really was an impressive, especially first time. I mean, I'm sure Key and Peele was a masterclass in how to, you know, create characters and make stories as quickly as possible with probably not a lot of budget and not a lot of time and not a lot of, but I mean, that still doesn't always sketch doesn't always translate into like, well, how do you tell a 90 minute story? Like, yeah. how do you let the characters breathe and really balance everything out very well?
Yeah. Very, very, yeah, an interesting transition. And I, you know, I was lucky with this one. I had enough time and it had marinated enough. And I could really, you know, I'm a total movie fan. So I really just, you know, I looked at my favorite movie. Movies, I dissected them. You know, I got, you know, scientific with it at times and just visceral and emotional with it in other times. But yeah, with Key and Peele, we got to, you know, produce like 300 short films, pretty much all of them helmed by Peter Atencio, mm-hmm. who's, you know, just ridiculously amazing talent. He did Keanu as well. And, you know, I figured like, hey, if I'm, you know, I love movies so much. I thought I just was insecure about the idea that I could actually direct one. But after Key and Peele, I was like, you know what? If I can't do it now, then there's, you know, I'll never be able to. No one can.
Well, you're not in it at all.
Yeah.
And so was there any point where the studio was like, you're not going to be in it? I mean, are you guys going to do characters? Are you guys going to, like, did you ever have to push back? No. This is a whole different, you know, because there's also, not just in terms of, you know, personal identity, but there's also this idea for you, I imagine, of coming out of Key and Peele, of establishing your own creative identity, mm-hmm. of like, oh, I'm a, you know, Keegan and I work together, but I'm separate, a separate person. Mm-hmm. This is my perspective on this. It's not going to be what you saw on that. Like, that is a, you know, that's a really smart move, I think, to establish yourself and not try to, you know, keep doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's only so much Key and Peele that people want to see, I think, at a certain point. And, you know, I think we left at the right time to, you know, we left when the show was, I think, was at its best. But to answer your question, yes, they, you know, there was, you know, questions, but, you know, do you want to play Rod? Do you want to, you know, it was this feeling, you know, you know, as you say, horror movies, we don't have an incredible budget. So the idea that, you know, I could bring a little bit of my fan base, you know, as an actor, and, you know, we could get me for cheap and that kind of thing, you know. The real thing that, you know, I'm not, acting is fun and it's cool. And I got to do it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I love directing. I love writing, and I love directing. And also, I'm not the biggest fan of myself as an actor. You know, I the people I put in this movie are there because I am fans of what they do. And I think it was probably the smartest decision not to sort of cave in and insert myself into it. Also, it's like tonally. It's important that this is a thriller and not that it doesn't go into, you know, parody land. And you people see me and it'll boom, that it's done.
Where's all the comedy?
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
He's going to do characters.
Yeah.
I think it's good to condition the audience of like, hey, I'm not going to do the same thing every time.
Yeah.
And you should just be prepared that it's not going to be that. Cause I didn't, you know, when it first started, my first thought was like, oh, is it going to be like a comedy horror or is it going to be? And then it's apparent pretty quickly that it's not like a, there's nothing slapsticky about it. There's no comedy. There's no winks to the audience. It's a very, it's like a straight ahead horror movie.
And it has, you know, when I was thinking about tone, I thought a lot about Scream.
Yep.
And how that has, you know, there's a, there's something satirical, but at the same time grounded in that there's an acknowledgement of that horror movies exist in this world.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that is, you know, it's the funny part of Scream, but they don't disrupt the horror because it exists in the real world.
Yeah.
So that was that, you know, I think with any sort of horror comedy hybrid, of which, you know, this, again, I call it a social thriller. I would liken it most to the Stepford Wives, but, you know, I acknowledge that there's a part of this movie that is satirical. And anytime you have a comedy horror hybrid of any sort, you know, I think if it works, it's this weird, unique film that has its own sort of alchemy of it.
Yeah.
You know, the Ghostbusters, Scream, Evil Dead. These are all like extremely different movies that all take place in this weird nebulous genre.
Well, yeah, where any comedy that comes out is situational, and it's not like we made a joke, you know. I mean, if you ever see the cut scenes from Ghostbusters, there's it's on one of the DVDs, but you see that they did a lot. There was a lot of like jokey joke stuff that Ivan Reitman cut out.
That they pulled out.
That we were like, oh my God, this would have been a totally different. You know, it was basically just Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd doing other characters.
Yeah, I blame Aykroyd for this, by the way. 100%. You know, Aykroyd was just like, well, you know, let's, you know, I think we should. Well, he's also, you know, obviously the guy that was just like science jargon.
Right.
Like he finds that funny. And you know, being raised by that film, I do too. but yeah, I mean, I think what I found with all of these movies that sort of exist on, you know, in horror and in comedy in some space, the most important notion is reality, that there's a groundedness. I think something's only going to be as funny as it is applied to the real world. I think something's only going to be as scary as it is applied to the real world. And the problem is the two genres can often set one another off. There's no reference point. There's no cohesion of what reality is. So I think, you know, talking about Ghostbusters, the reason that movie is so dope is because the scary scenes are scary. The funny scenes, are funny, you know. Bill Murray's just going at it with the improv, but the movie feels kind of real in this weird way. Like they're blue collar plumbers. This is like, what if you needed like a citywide exorcist squad in real life New York, and that undercurrent of reality allows you to access both genres.
And the practical effects.
And then the practical effects
were unlike, I mean, they were so different. And to have a comedy film that had that layer of, you know, where they usually skimp on that, like, oh, it's a comedy, we'll just make it dopey. You know, like, but there was a legitimate, you know, I remember watching MTV movie specials about the making of the, you know, and they'd show you how, oh, here's how they did Slimer, and here's how they did the thing where all the ghosts have been released from the containment unit, and the Elmer Bernstein music, like it was a great movie and like on like 10 different levels.
Is it just us or is that still not just better? A good practical effect, to me, it just is better.
Well, I've had this conversation. I think a mix is the best. It's you have maybe a practical body and a CG, because there are a lot of great, you know, I've been on the sort of practical effects rant before, and then, you know, people email me who are CG artists and they're like, hey, you know, there's an art to this too. I go, no, of course.
Yeah, there's an art.
But, you know, there are very few. You know, like Jurassic Park is great, or
Small Soldiers.
Rocket Raccoon is unbelievable in Guardians, like really unbelievable. But, you know, it's But a lot, when things are fully CG'd, most of the time you go, oh, that looks really good for CG.
Right.
But, you know, it's very rare.
But, and you're right. And the thing about Jurassic Park and Small Soldiers is, you know, they melded it. They mixed it, like you said.
Right.
I agree with you. I think that trumps everything because it creates this sort of seamless blend of, okay, I know that creature is existing there, but it's, how are they making it feel real, like a real animal?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I think the abandonment of the practical effects is a little bit of a shame.
I think yeah, coming up with a nice hybridized version of, you know, just finding the right places to add the details with the CG, but exactly, still having the, you know, of course, it's so easy to say movies should just do this.
Yeah.
But usually it just boils down to budget and what's available and
hey,
resources.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What do you direct? Have you thought about directing? You should.
I don't think I'd be a good director. I really don't.
I think you would. Look, here's the thing that you know, you realize about directing. It's, you can be, if you're, first of all, if you're a fan, if you have, like for me, it was all about having this knowledge of what I like. And Bradley Whitford said it to me in a way that made me feel very comforted. He said, man, you know, look, this directing thing, man, it's just taste. It's taste. If you got good taste, you can pull it off. So I think you got,
well,
to,
I don't know.
Taste.
I just, the I thing that stresses taste. Me out about it is that, I think you really need to, it's not even so much having to be the captain of the vision. It's mm-hmm. like, you're really guiding this, you know, you're really standing on the backs of artisans, like a great DP and a great lighting guy and a great music guy and great actors and a great, you know, what always kind of fucks me up about ever thinking about doing it is, I feel like I would just stand in an edit bay and look at the almost infinite possibilities for how a story could be played out, and I just start screaming.
I guess
it's like in Real Genius. I'm wearing the Real Genius. Like in Real Genius when they're studying for finals, and the one guy just gets up and goes, like, and he just runs out. Like, I feel like that's what that would do to me.
It, dude, there's the anxiety, and it is. You will do that, and it is like the most stressful thing I've ever done. I was Skyping Chelsea from Alabama where we shoot it, just weeping some days. And not because I wasn't having fun, but it's just the pressure is pretty intense. But, you know, when you brought up the word captain, like that's the other side of it, is it feels like you are the captain of a pirate ship. You know, there's this sense of adventure. There's this sense of destination. There's the sense that you know, yes, you have like these geniuses around you who are all masters of what they do, and you're wielding this power, but you know, you have to take these moments to just breathe in the salt air and say, man, I'm here. And that, I, you know, that makes it worth it.
It sounds amazing. I just don't know if I have a director's, I don't know if I have a director's eye, because we'll watch movies and Lydia will go, wow, the composition with the trees there. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even notice that. Like, I'm so dumb. Yeah. Like, I'm just watching that guy run around. Like, yeah. she notices all those things. But I don't know. It sounds amazing, but I really feel like it really needs to be in your bones to be a good director. Like, you really need to be, it's like with comedy, you know, like you can't really half-ass it. I mean, you can, but, you know, if you, but you also, I feel like what really is scaring me away from doing it is just not feeling like I'm so into it that I would be able to give 110% and not focus on anything else.
Well, look, so. I mean, it's like we're such fans of the art form.
Yeah.
So the notion that, oh, man, if there's whatever my blind spot is, if I get in there and then, yeah, like you said, see in the editing room, oh, no, I've made one of these films. That is like, that's tragedy. That is like, you have to, you know, the idea of failing after watching movies with such scrutiny and, like, you know, critiquing people's works and like celebrating it, it's daunting.
Well, I'm so much more sensitive now and empathetic to Because we'll watch horror movies and I will out loud go, why are they doing, oh fuck, are you so, okay, now he's probably gonna do, okay, there he did, you know. I do that, Lydia and I do that, yeah. But then at the end of it, I always know as a creator, you know, when people go, hey, how come you did this way, or this sucked, why'd you do that, and you go, well, you know, sometimes things just happen the way they happen, and right. It's that, you know, it's the drawing in your head isn't always the drawing that comes out on the paper with mm-hmm. when your hand starts manifesting it. So I try to be really forgiving of that stuff. Yeah. But I don't know. What did you learn the most from the start to finish?
Well, you know, when what you're talking about is actually, you know, cool. It's you have this vision in your head of what the, you know, what the film is. You have this vision of, you have this idea of what it certainly isn't. And then you put the pieces together and there's an alchemy, and you know, there's some scenes you go, wow, that's what I pictured. That's exactly I'm seeing it. Other scenes, it's, you know, it's completely different, and it's like, oh, okay, this kind of became something different, and that's cool. But you kind of can have this, the experience at the end of the whole thing of sitting back, watching the movie and watching it. Like it's fresh, because it's never going to be exactly the film you pictured.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So you just have to be flexible, I imagine.
Yeah. And just all the voices you bring in, are going to be bringing their voices to it. So, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who's like, you know, going to be like a Kubrick, Cameron, like if you don't, if it's not exactly how I pictured it, fuck off. It's not, you know, it's not that for me. I'm into the collaboration. I'm into the sense that this is going to be something bigger than even I can imagine.
I'm going to say something that's probably very sacrilegious right now, but when I hear stories about Kubrick, it's like, he shot that one scene like 100 times.
Yeah.
I kind of go, well, that's not, is that art? I mean, you know, it's like,
right.
Yeah. It's just sort of like, you
it's
know,
madness.
It's burst shooting. You know, yeah. I can burst shoot. And listen, I'm not saying it's easy.
I know what you mean.
But when I hear those stories, I'm like, well, I don't know. It just kind of sounds like
let's see what he can do if he gets
two takes.
Two takes.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see what he can put together.
Well, two takes Kubrick. I don't know if it's good. It's great. You know, yeah. Like, I mean, you know, of course he was masterful, but that's where I kind of feel like, well, I don't know. I mean, if you know, I guess if you shoot something every day for a year, in that year, you're going to be able to use.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you know, I think one of the best things that I got.
Take that, Kubrick.
Take that.
Yes.
I spit on your grave. You hack.
Also a fun movie.
Also a fun movie. Yeah. we obviously we love Kubrick.
Well, I'm curious. So, you and Keegan came on, I think, it might have been like 5 years ago now,
something like that.
But Key and Peele was just kind of taking off when you came on. Like, it had just started.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it, again, a lot of things happened for legal reasons, but for the longest time, Comedy Central, Viacom kind of had this thing with YouTube, and so they couldn't really put YouTube clips in. And mm-hmm. I think Key and Peele was one of the first shows, I imagine probably Tara Schuster or someone over there
nailed
was like,
it.
Hey, you know, Tara does social, like she
that's
does
right.
stuff for yes. At Midnight too, in terms of like all this kind of, you know, planning and plotting and scheming, and she's brilliant.
Yeah.
But saying like, hey, you know, this needs to go on a place where people can see it. And then mm-hmm. all of these clips start exploding. And then, you know, very quickly you guys are like when people say sketchos, you know, Kids in the Hall, mm-hmm. you know, Saturday Night Live, Key and Peele, you know,
dope.
Like you guys are up in that echelon.
Oh, hey.
But when that was happening, did it feel like that, or did you notice anything different? Did you, were you worried about becoming too aware of that stuff?
When I knew that I was going to get to make this sketch show with Keegan Michael Key, I knew we would have something special, because first of all, he's the funniest actor I've ever seen, funniest performer I've ever worked with. So I knew that the potential was there, and I knew it was going to be tricky because we'd have to, you know, honor all of the things that influenced us. But the whole point of sketch is it's got to be It's got to be dangerous. You have these little, you got these little bursts where you can step out on a ledge and like just explore the edge of what's okay to do. So it was. But then, yeah, the, you know, as you noted, Tara Schuster, who is just like kind of ahead of her, you know, time. She can just sort of see the future a little bit, and with. With regards to and the whole digital team at Comedy Central was just really, really great. And originally the whole idea was, hey, let's put some sketches out there to get eyes on the show, and we'll advertise the show. And this was this sort of dawning in a way of what I thought of as the dawning of short form and YouTube happening. So there was no concept that could actually end up being the platform that the show is the most successful on. The ratings on the TV show never even compared to the amount of hits on YouTube.
Why can't 150 million people watch our show?
Come on, we got it. It's right here.
Well, if 150 million people watched your television show,
yeah,
they would just give you the network.
Yeah, right. Like, they would just give it to it.
Here's $1 billion. Don't ever do anything else ever again. That's right.
And so, you're right. There was a, for whatever reason, certainly in, our contracts, we didn't have anything that acknowledged any YouTube, any kind of viral thing at all. We didn't even know that was possible. So there really was not a healthy monetization of that phenomenon for us. Now, we haven't made jack shit. It's all promotional, right? And then, of course, it promotes other people watching other YouTube clips. So, it's like, it's this interesting thing where we feel like this is resonating, and we hit this place and time where, we're putting, high quality, well directed, well designed material with a little bit of money, a little more money than the competition on YouTube. Mm-hmm. We're getting to sort of have a little bit of the monopoly on actually produced content on online. And we weren't aware of what that would happen. So by the end of our term on Comedy Central, I think we were done just because we felt like a little burnt out. Maybe like we couldn't top ourselves, like we had done a good job. But it also we felt like we had created a huge thing that it was sort of impossible to benefit from.
Sure. Sure, sure, sure. I probably, like Mike Judge with Beavis and Butthead, or, mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this is such a phenomenon, but maybe it just sort of lays the groundwork for you to go on and do the next thing. But it's still a very bold move to leave a show when it's really still in its prime. Like, when you really, you could have, like, I think, there's a certain perspective that's like, yeah, you could have done a couple more seasons and it probably would have been that. But you guys said, no, it just feels good to leave right now. And that's a very hard thing to do, I think. And it's a very, did it feel scary at all? Or were you like, no, we emotionally can't do this anymore?
It didn't. First of all, I knew I had something like Get Out to say. And I was very excited to move to this, this part of my passion. And it also felt like, yeah, I mean, we are at this point where there is an attention to the show, that we have a really loyal fan base, and we have this opportunity to have people, wishing for more, wishing they have more. And that just like you said, I feel like that if we had gone a couple years, it could have been great. We could have done the best seasons of Key and Peele that's possible. But it's also possible for us to plateau.
Sure.
And that for some of that excitement to die down. So, ultimately for me, I just want to have the ability to make these stories that are bubbling out of me, and I'd rather do that and be poor.
But did you ever
than to be super duper rich and sort of feel like I don't have my, I'm not following my passion.
Totally understand. I mean, it, because I would imagine it, as you're going through it and you comedy starts the same, is where you feel like, no one's really paying attention. I kind of do whatever I want, flying under the radar, you know. Boy, I sure wish more people would notice what I'm doing. And then more people start noticing. And then is there any pressure? Where I'm going with this is when Chappelle left Chappelle's Show. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that part of it was all of a sudden everyone was really paying attention to what he was doing before, which in a way kind of fucks up comedy a little bit. Because comedy should be sort of intimate, I think. And I think he was noticing, like, you know, every statement that he made all of a sudden was a newsworthy thing, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like he was becoming more, my manager has a great way of saying, he's like, oh, you never want to be more famous than funny, you know? And mm-hmm. I feel like, I wonder if he was struggling with becoming, like, getting worrying about, oh, I don't want to become too famous because mm-hmm. I want to be funny. And also, I think he sort of felt like, I feel like the wrong people are laughing at this stuff for the wrong reasons. You know, mm-hmm. it's like when he does the blind KKK guy mm-hmm. or whatever. He's like, oh, I don't know if the right. Yeah. I don't know if this is funny to people for the right reason. You know, like feeling pressure for some of the stuff he was putting out, that it was resonating in the right way. Did you guys feel that through the process?
Well, you know, to the first point of you know, the idea of getting bigger than you are funny, I think there was definitely a fear there that it does seem like comedy has this weird expiration date. I mean, I feel like there's no, you know, the best comedians that, you know, I've seen in my lifetime, there's a point where the laughter stops. that's a terrifying thing to me. So I much more, you know, much more comfortable to step away than to let the world go, okay, these guys aren't fresh and interesting anymore. They're yesterday's. Who's the new one? Who's the new one?
Right.
Then when it comes to the question of who's laughing, why they're laughing, I understand what Dave Chappelle meant. I'll say that I feel like it's very different to have to have the burden of the stress of a show like that on his shoulders, as opposed to be able to share it with a partner. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, I also think for me, I have to, you know, when I ask myself, well, how would I feel if you know, a psychopath loved one of my sketches that ends in a dark way and he's laughing for the wrong reason, that is a scary notion that you're feeding into evil. But you know, you kind of can't go there, or I can't go there.
You can't control everyone.
All I can really ask myself is what do I want to see? What do I want to make? What's my voice? What's my humor? And then say, look, if Idi Amin wants to send me an email thanking me for my show, that's his business. I didn't make it for him, but it's all right.
When you met the president for the first time, mm-hmm. how do you process? I mean, because there's no way you can be just totally chill with that. I mean, like, it must be, oh fuck, this is the president. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and it's sort of based on the fact that, you know, we're doing a thing that's near him comedically. It's, yeah. you know, I wasn't insulting to him, but it was definitely like, he seems like he has a good sense of humor, but I don't know. What, mm-hmm. you know, what was,
well, you know, the best part was he said, these guys can't peel. They got this anger translator, Luther. It's pretty good stuff. You know, so for him to say that, for us, that was like, oh, wait a second. We created this character, Luther, to express what we felt like he wanted to say, and to express, quite frankly, what a lot of us wish he would say, or we wanted to say. And for him to acknowledge that that was funny meant to us, A, that was in fact what he wishes he could say. And it also meant that, you know, in some ways he had anointed Luther his actual anger translator. So for us, that was the surreal thing. Was like we created this idea of Luther, and he's become real. And then of course, you know, cut to a couple of years later when you know Keegan's at the correspondence dinner, literally doing Luther with Obama. You know, and they're trying to figure out some way for me to. You know, am I going to do Obama Luther, and then he's going to come out? What's going to be? And I was like, no. You got to. This is the moment where Luther becomes real. It's so surreal, Chris. I can't even tell you.
You know, that sort of comedy at its most powerful form, like its purest form, is satire that really affects. The culture affects social change, affects, you know, like is really part of the conversation and not just, jokes for joke's sake.
Absolutely. And that I think is what the power of sketch is. And the tools you have at your disposal with a sketch show is that it's quick fire. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we had a little bit more time, but a show like SNL, they're putting together their sketches in 1 week, and then by the end of the week it's gone. So they have the ability to talk about what is happening right now, and so to do that, it's like they've you know, and they've made over the many years that show's been on, they've made very good on their commitment to discussing the truths of now.
Right.
And so I think the work they're doing right now is extremely important. And I think that the voices of comedians right now are, really one of the most, powerful weapons we have against, hate and evil in this world.
I'll tell you too, if it's any indication about how difficult it is to do a good sketch show. Just think about how many sketch shows are on TV at the moment. Exactly. I mean, it's like with hundreds and hundreds of channels, how many, I can think of like two.
You have to, it's got to be constantly reinventing itself. You can't just go back. You can't just do sketch in the mold of another sketch show. You can't really make a sketch in the mold of, a sketch you've previously made, unless you're Mad TV, then you can just hit those characters over and over and over.
Did that start to get after a while? You're like, really? Should I do this stuff again? Like, did you guys on Mad? Did you want to do a bunch of new stuff? And they go, well, you know, people want to see this, so maybe just do this.
I can speak for myself personally. I was on Mad TV. I was always trying to do. New sketches. That's the, you know, I had no interest in really developing the recurring characters, which, by the way, it plays because people do enjoy a certain sense of familiarity. They enjoy a sense of routine and ritual when they go to television. You know, what I love about sketch is that through the story of all the different sketches, you can build a cohesion. The story doesn't need to be the same. It's kind of like the Twilight Zone. There's every story is unique, but there's a through line to it. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Twilight Zone.
Right.
They've branded it. So that was what I was trying to do. And so for me, Mad TV was in some ways just a surreal and wonderful experience, because all of a sudden I was, you know, getting paid to be on TV and do this thing. But I think I have a different approach ultimately to comedy. And, you know, what Keegan and I ended up doing with Key and Peele is that's my real voice.
You know, when you're talking about comedy and its role in, you know, like really being able to take on, I mean, obviously historically that's what comedy is. You know, comedy is a defense mechanism. Comedy is communal. Comedy says things that we, you know, would be weird to just say in normal conversation. You know, it's elevated and it's exaggerated. And there's a quote that I always fucking go back to, especially now, but it came from Greg Proops And it was probably 15 years ago during the Bush administration.
Which Proops quote are you talking about?
He was performing. Blaine Kapatch told me about this, and he was performing somewhere, and he made some crack about Bush, and like some guy in the audience got all mad. And I mean, Greg kind of loves that because he just loves to like that's when the Iron Giant turns into the gun, you know?
Right.
That's when Greg. It's like he kind of really gets off on that. Uh-huh. But he just, you know, like his nose went up in the air and he goes, it's okay to laugh at things you don't agree with. It's called sophistication. Nice, and it just fucking, nice. Like, Blaine said, it's destroyed.
Yeah.
And I really think about that now that we're in this time where people feel like if they don't agree with something 100%, it's their mortal enemy. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, you can still laugh at things even if you don't. Even if you don't feel like I'm 100% on the side, like, oh, okay, well, that's good.
I mean, the internet has changed everything, right? It really has. Like, I mean, first of all, just the way we watch things, it's like the knowledge that all of our opinions can be shared and heard, and it is new, and I think it's cool. I think it's ultimately a good thing because it brings the world closer together. But you know, with this. Technological development, you know, there's a little bit of a reset button on humanity. You know, it feels like the internet is this kind of barbaric frontier where the rules aren't completely written yet. There is an anonymity to it. So we all, I liken it to like, imagine the Wild West if everyone had a mask.
Of course. But it's also, I mean, it'll be interesting in like 100 years for people to look back and see, to be able to really get some runway behind them and go, oh, this is it. Because mm-hmm. it really does, it changes the conversation so much because it's an entirely different language. It's mm-hmm. of communication.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, when else in culturally did humanity have such a drastic universal change mm-hmm. in in the way that people communicate?
Yeah,
it's really strange, and I don't think we've even really just begun to even process it yet.
Absolutely not. You know, I think the thing that seems closest to me is television, right? Television, all of a sudden, you know, and to what you're saying, it's not that people, you know, it gave people a platform to actually communicate what they were saying, but it did a similar thing in that everyone had a TV in their home mm-hmm. all of a sudden in the 60s. And it made the world smaller.
Yes.
And so a lot of, you know, what happened in the 60s, like that crazy time.
Stays in the 60s. I completely ruined a really good point.
No, it's good. I got it. It was like those things that make the world smaller, those technological advances, it's almost like it's like a shot of steroids to our culture.
Sure.
All of a sudden people could see the president get assassinated. All of a sudden people could see the civil rights movement and black people getting hosed in the streets. And so the effect that it had, you know, it had some, you know, it had both sides. It had the bringing people together in a positive way, but it also had, you know, these violent clashes and these, you know, I feel like it just speeds up progress for better or worse,
right?
Which is I like to think ultimately for better in the big picture.
Well, I know I think maybe I have like 3 more minutes before you're okay. swooped away.
Okay,
because I imagine are you doing a bunch of press today? Is this?
Oh
is
yeah,
crazy
I mean,
press
well, this today is the premiere part.
Holy
the,
shit!
Yeah, the big event.
You excited?
Oh, you know I. It's so surreal. You know, I really hope I can enjoy this. I have a feeling it'll be like 10 years and I'll be like, what did I had a premiere once. I had my first premiere. I didn't enjoy it at the time, but
kid,
no.
You got to enjoy your premieres.
Yeah.
I think honestly, if you get out there on the carpet or like right when the lights go down and people are watching a movie, if you just take a breath and just sort of try to make as many mental notes of like, oh, you know, I'm sitting here and this is what I'm seeing and just like really experience, like take a real snapshot.
Mm-hmm. It might feel like the pirate captain. Now he's in port and it's the journey's over. And it'll be bittersweet.
But the journey's just beginning.
That's what I like.
I hope, I really hope that people go out and see the movie because it's really great. And I know I gushed about it a lot at the beginning, but again, as a horror fan, and also as someone who I consider a friend,
yes.
It's really nice to see your friends. Like, wow, that's awesome to see that Jordan did that. He could have done all these other things, and he did that, and it's, you know, and it worked.
Thank you. And I didn't think, I really doubted myself, and so I just want to say to anybody who thinks they can do it, write the movie that you want to see first.
Yeah.
Write your favorite movie that doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I think that sort of gets down to the root of. I talk about it with comedy a lot, but I think it applies to horror movies too, or any film in general. It's like, you know, there are some comics that are, there are some things, artistic things that are really good about relating to the audience. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I know people are going to like this. I'll say this because they'll like this. Those are the things that you might be entertained by, but you don't really remember them. They don't stick mm-hmm. with you. And then there are those artistic things or people or comics or movies where they sort of force you to relate to them. Mm. And that, I think, is the real... That's like really where the art lives. Wow.
That's a great comment. No one's put it like that, and I love that.
Yeah, and I really feel like you accomplished this with Get Out. So please go out and see Get Out. What is the actual opening day?
February 24th.
February 24th.
Yeah.
Jordan Peele directed. Great cast. Great movie. And thank you so much for being here. And congratulations when's the baby due?
Early July. We got July 3rd due date. So
God, that's like, oh my God,
Baby America.
That's gonna be that's right around the corner.
That's right around. Oh my gosh. Yep.
No Comic Con for you this year.
That's right.
You're gonna be in Baby Con.
I'm gonna be in Baby Con.
Well, please pass on my congratulations to Chelsea.
I will.
And. I feel like I never see anyone anymore because I don't. Is she performing?
Well,
pregnant.
You know what? She just did the Crunchies.
Oh, nice!
And crushed. And of course she's Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yep.
So she's busy and developing stuff. She's got a lot of cool stuff going on.
Well, congratulations again, and thanks for being here, Jordan.
Anytime, literally anytime. Even if there's no microphones, let's nerd out.
Yes, you should come over and hang out. Yeah. We have video games.
Yeah.
I got the Nintendo Classic hooked up right there, which looks amazing on this TV.
No, I want to watch some stuff.
We're gonna watch some stuff.
Dope.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 65th National Finals of Distinguished Young Women.
Every year, one girl from every state leaves her family, her whole life behind, for 2 weeks and spends each day training, practicing, preparing. Because to win this competition, she needs to wow a panel of judges with her academic record, her athletic ability, her speaking skills, and a show-stopping talent.
I met her and I was like, she's gonna win.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
When I sing that song about being a black woman in America, there's gonna be backlash about that.
Oh, I'm just so happy. So happy.
I don't want to see them. I don't want to talk to them.
And then we stayed with them for the next year, unpacking just what happened those 2 weeks in Mobile. I'm Shimol Yai, and from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.